Okay, well, welcome to today's PLC. For those of you that are new, we're HMTRI. We work with EPA as a bridge between communities who would like to start job training programs and grantees and past grantees, people who are interested in learning about job training, and EPA. So we serve that intermediary function. And we do a lot of things. We'll be talking about all grantee meetings, and we'll be talking about our toolbox and things. But one of the things we also do, we do research in environmental job training and jobs. One of the things we do is have the professional learning community, which we're all talking about today. Every 2 weeks during each cycle, we'll talk about different topics that people would like to learn about. Lately, we're talking about placement, and the reason we're doing that is many of our grantees now have gone into their first, second, or third cycle, and their graduates either have graduated or are in the process of graduating, and we felt it would be a good time to talk about placement, placement strategies, and also we like to learn about the different grantees, what they're doing in their program, about their what kind of people they're targeting, what the turf looks like basically, what kind of curriculum they've got, and of course now today we'll be also focusing on problems they have with placement and tracking and what they're doing in the placement tracking area. The whole idea is to do some idea exchange, and you might pick up something that you haven't thought of before in the area of placement, or what someone else is doing, or you might have an idea that you could share with the group. So that's the purpose of the PLC, or the Professional Learning Community. Last PLC we had Santa Fe Community College, which is quite a different grant than the one we're going to talk about today. They're on opposite sides of the country, in Santa Fe and Brooklyn, New York. Their demographics are completely different. One's rural, in my mind, more rural as you combine it with New York, as you compare it. It serves as a nice contrast between a very diverse Native American, not a lot of employers, not highly populated people with diverse education levels, ethnic backgrounds, and a few employers. And we talked about what they do and how some of the ideas they've used for placement. Now we're going to talk to Ivan today in just a little bit about what happens in the Northeast in a very populated city with a whole lot of environmental issues, probably still a diverse and a lot of disparities in his population. And we'll talk about some of the things they're doing, some of the things they're having problems with, some of the things that seem to go pretty well. So before we get started on talking about St. Nick's and what they're doing, is we usually talk about what's going on in Washington, what's going on amongst HMTRI and what we're doing. I'll remind you that if you're on the PLC list, which if you got reminders today you are or want to be put on that list, we'll send you, of course, notices that of the next one, which is every 2 weeks. The next one's August 28th, same time, same place, same call-in. We'll also send you post-session notes, which will go in much more detail, so you really don't have to take notes about this discussion. And if there's websites, upcoming meetings, anything that we would like to pass on to you, we always, some of it's a little repetitive, such as almost every issue now we're putting in things like things you should be doing now if you submitted a grant, just as a reminder. We're also putting in there what the schedule looks like for those who sent in grants, what we know from EPA and what we hear, what the schedule look like in the coming months and in actually into the coming years. So give you an idea of where we're at, so you'll have as much information as we have and as much as EPA can share with us. So before we get started, we always talk about Washington and HMTRI. And Heather, could you give everyone your email address so that if you're not getting post-session notes, and you'll get them on Friday, if you don't get them, just send Heather your contact information. You want to give them that?
Absolutely. So you can reach me at H hkballou at eicc.edu. Again, that's hkballou at eicc.edu.
And we'll put you on our list to get these notes. We have about 460 people across the country, and sometimes they can get to the PLC and sometimes they can't, and they always get the notes. So, and of course, often they'll leave for other jobs and then they'll just send us a note to remove them from the list. So we like to have our alumni. We have alumni EPA people who come back and visit us on the PLC. We have alumni grantees who may not be active now and they come back and visit just at their leisure. So again, every 2 weeks, same time, same place, and we'll send you notices. So Heather, what's tell us about what's going on in Washington today.
Well, right now it's kind of same song that we've been singing for a while here. Biggest thing is that, you know, we're in that long wait period. So right now they're reviewing all the different grant proposals that they received. And so again, and just anticipating announcing selections at the end of October. So we'll just kind of keep that in mind as we go forward, couple more months wait, but we're getting closer. The other big thing that they always want us to remind you guys of is that the National Brownfields Conference will occur this year in Los Angeles, and that is December 11th through the 13th. Now, keep in mind, though, HMTRI, we're actually hosting our all-grantee meeting this year as an affiliate workshop event that's going to be occurring on December 10th at the Los Angeles Convention Center. So the same place as the National Brownfields Conference. We're just going to start the day before, kind of have a full day of programming planned that day out. So a really great way to kind of get those two birds with one stone. Go ahead and get the all-grantee meeting in and the National Brownfields Conference in one trip. Keep that in mind as you go. The all-grantee meeting is a great opportunity to connect with other grantees and EPA folk, as well as opportunities for networking and discussions based off of your guys' interest in what is going on. So we are still, I know this is a little late with some of these things. We are still finalizing some details. This is something brand new and totally novel that we're trying to do. So it's taking a little bit longer to hash out a couple of the details. But we will be sending out in the next couple of weeks here, we're probably going to be sending out a scan where we will actually ask you guys, you know, based off this list of topics, what sounds interesting to you? What would you like us to talk about? What would you like us to explore more at this all grantee meeting? So keep an eye out for that. We'll send a big reminder and it'll be pushed out on the listserv as well. But we're really excited and looking forward to that opportunity. The other thing is, I believe Mike mentioned last week that there is an opportunity for those of you that may be in the Florida region to do a environmental workforce development workshop. So these are the folks that are sort of, they're having a opportunities for looking for funding and resources to develop and train local workforces. So initially they had two dates that they were looking at. They've now decided to combine the forces into one date, and that'll actually occur August 21st from 1 to 5 p.m. at the Florida State University in Panama City, Florida. So keep an eye out for the notes that'll come through from Mike later on at the end of this week, and you'll be able to find more detailed information on there, or if you can send me an email if you're curious and want to learn a little bit more about that as well.
Great. Just to informally kind of tell you what we're planning, for those of you who have been in the program for many years, we always, for the last 20 years, have had an all-grantee meeting in Alexandria, almost the same hotel every year. We have a chance to meet with EPA people and the regional coordinators. It's usually a two-day boot camp, and we pay for 3 days of hotel. So all you'd have to do is get to Alexandria in August. In fact, it's usually right about this time. This year, everything went topsy-turvy. The RFPs went out later. The new grantees, the new round of grantees won't be announced till after October 1st. Probably the awards will be more like towards the end of October. By the time you get your ability to spend money and things like that, it might be late October, early November. EPA we were working, how do we do this? Because if we had it in August, like we always have, people would have to travel twice because they really like people to go to the national meeting. There's about 3,000 or 4,000 people there. And that all the regional coordinators, the administrator of EPA, our assistant administrators there. So we went back and forth, and we found that what we could do is, in fact, the project officer thought this would be great if you could do it, and we can, just postpone your all grantee meeting from August and move it to before, just in the same place, same hotels, just before the national conference. And now the devil is in the details. We are trying to get permission so we could pay at least 2 days of your housing, attend our meeting, our all-grantee meeting, and then go on and attend the national meeting. There's some real advantages in this. Of course, you only have to go to one meeting instead of they were encouraging everyone to go to both, because the all-grantee meeting is a great meeting for meeting all the other grantees and talking to EPA people. But the other benefits of doing this is all the regional coordinators will be there, all the people from EPA will be there, and best off, a lot of employers, any employer who's recognized in environment will be there with a booth or with representatives, and we're going to be bringing them into the meeting. Another benefit is we're going to try to do some joint meetings with some of the NIHS people who have a program that's similar but different than our program. It's a worker career, environmental worker career development program. And we're going to see, and all of this is still in flux, we're going to see if we could do a half day of our own meeting and then work on some common issues with the NIHS grantees, things like apprenticeships and recruitment and placement and things like that. So that's kind of what's coming down the stream. And I know you may be getting announcements to sign up for the national meeting. We're going to, of course, we're going to be doing it the day before on the 10th. We'll be sending out announcements, and as soon as we get things settled about hotel and all of that, we'll be sending those out to you. So once we get permissions from EPA to do the things we want to do and get this settled, we'll be sending out a scan, you know, are you planning on coming, so we can get a good head count. And then after that, what would you like to talk about in our joint meeting and our individual meetings? What kind of things can you use some help on, or do you think would help you to improve your program? So that's kind of what's going on. Any other meetings, I'll put in the post-session notes, which you'll get on Friday, including the Florida meeting and a bunch of other ones coming up, including for those of you who are current grantees, there's an ACRES training seminar on September 11th. So, but that'll all be in the post-session notes. So I want to get to St. Nick's. This St. Nick's is a great program. You know, they were formed in about in the 70s, 1974, with a fire, a neighborhood fire. And it was originally the church came out to help the community. It was a mess. Unemployment, a poor part of Brooklyn. The neighborhood got together, and they've gotten stronger and stronger over the years. Originally, it was the St. Nicholas Catholic Church, and then they went to the nonprofit. They went to St. Nick's Neighborhood Preservation Corps, and then they more recently went to St. Nick's Alliance. And all along, they have formed this great community group, which does a whole lot more than just environmental workforce training. They do a whole lot more, but they do this. And they've been doing the Environmental Workforce Development Job Training Program since 2002. They most recently received funding in the competition in 2018. So they've been doing environmental training and placement for a long time. Now, not continuously, though. They have faced a lot of problems over the years. They were unfunded for several years. They could do a whole nother session on sustainability, because they survived unfunded years keeping their program going and bringing it back most recently. The neighborhood's got, 13 toxic waste dumps. It's got hazardous 390 waste sites. They've got Superfund sites, polluted rivers, scrap yards, transfer stations, polluted waterways, everything you could imagine. And they've put together a program that's outstanding, and I think I've probably said enough about the program. I'll let Ivan tell us a little about the program and tell us about what he's doing and maybe how some of the strategies and things he's doing to get his graduates placed. Ivan, I'm just going to turn it over to you.
That was actually a really good introduction. So at St. Nick's, we place about, on an average, 75% of our graduating class, which is about 60 per year. The field is definitely very lucrative in sustainable projects due to the fact that there are a lot of issues that reside in New York and Brooklyn itself. We definitely have issues with water cleanup. There's a lot of initiatives pushing for local lakes and creeks to be cleaned. There's a new initiative and a lot of bills have been passed to promote solar installation, which then helps us to then make sure that our participants are certified so that they can actually transition into assisting on these solar initiatives. There's a lot of hazardous removal. We actually do run a construction program, which is similar, but we notice that people who are going into environmental remediation, they definitely need to acquire their OSHA 30, which then allows them to then remove hazardous waste from buildings. In New York City, there's a lot of renovations of old buildings. There are a lot of new buildings that are being built. So that then leads us to place more people. We actually have a committee that allows us to stay abreast of all of the new certifications that is needed to work on any of these sites. We certify our participants with about 4 mandatory certifications that allows them to have fluidity through the field. There are OSHA 30, the 40-hour HAZWOPER, asbestos handler, which is state and city licenses, and we do confined spacing. In our experience of working with in this field, we noticed that since St. Nick's is more of a community-based organization, we focus a lot on the career paths of our participants. We noticed that if we hone in on their skills and kind of give them a vision of where they want to be in their career, it definitely allows them to be placed at sites and also to stay there so that they can obviously get promotions and then move up in the company. Phoenix has been very successful at making sure that when participants are enrolled, they definitely get certified, and then they definitely have an open line of communication with us. We actually have an account manager that has been very successful in getting employers involved even before they're certified so that they can see how the industry actually is firsthand from people who's already established, and then they can tell them firsthand stories of how to maneuver through the system. And then while they graduate, we have them come back in again and then assess them, reassess them with the certifications to then get them placed. This is a new technique that I realize a lot of workforce have been doing. We have been using that formula, and it has been very successful. We also have alumni events where we also want people in the field to then meet the incoming students, because we realize that community element does help, because then it helps them share their experiences. It helps with retention, it helps with job security, and it also helps with the agency brand on a whole. Advice on, I say that definitely make sure that it's person-centered, and St. Nick's is a, we obviously want them to be placed on the job, but we're definitely advocates of sustainable projects and to make sure that we actually care about the environment, and we also want employers to know that we're advocating not just for the environment, but also for the participants so they can get fair wages. And that's it.
Good. I've got, certainly we may have some questions, but, you know, now what do you do? Let's talk a little bit about two things that, of course, everybody's grappling with today. One is drug use, drug testing, and then I'd like to talk about ex-offenders. What do you do in the in terms of drug testing, and what's your policy for people that say I want to get into this program? How do you do then?
So Phoenix, we have a requirement that we only accept people who can pass a drug test. We administer that drug test prior to being enrolled in the program. Offenders, we actually do accept people who have been incarcerated, but they cannot have any felonies or misdemeanors in the field where it will prevent them from working, such as they cannot steal from environmental remediation site or some kind of construction site, or as long as it's not related, we definitely can still work with them. Because we know that when we're dealing with employers, they actually do random drug testing. So we don't want that to be a reason that disqualifies people. So we want them to be clean even before they do the program.
Mm-hmm. New York has a ban the box, which for those of you who, some of the states have banned the box and others don't, it essentially says you can't deny an interview to someone. You shouldn't have a box on there that says, you know, have you ever do you have a criminal history of any kind? Doesn't mean that they're going to get the job, but at least they can get past the first interview. One of the things that we talked about one time with St. Nick's, it's interesting, for your ex-offenders, and I don't know if you still do this, for your graduates, if you've got an ex-offender, and even some of your other graduates who may have some issues, you have this incredible relationship with your employers where you might sit down with that employer and look 90 days out and say you have a graduate and he's got a parole, he's got a hearing, or he's got a report to a parole officer, or it may even be someone who's got other issues, maybe daycare issues or it might be medical issues. You sit down with that employer and say, you know, for the next 90 days, next 3 months, I've got someone who'd really like this job, but he's going to have these problems. He's going to have some absences, and we want to talk about this before you offer him the job or before he accepts it, so that the employer is up to speed. He's just not all of a sudden the guy doesn't show up, and mm-hmm. Oh well, I had to go to a parole office. No, the employer knew way in advance these things are going to happen, so they're not going to be marks against them. It sounds like it's a great proactive approach that you use for your graduates.
Yes, it's actually been very successful because it allows us to make deals with employers and let them assess their work ethic and not their personal behaviors that will prevent them from employment.
Yeah, and I assume you'll never send out a graduate on an interview if you don't know that he can't succeed. In other words, you know your employers well enough that you're not going to send someone out and they're going to say, oh, nobody told me you did this or did that, or you have this problem. And so right off the bat, he gets rejected and has a negative viewpoint of the whole field. So
yeah.
Now you also work with organized labor, don't you?
Yes.
That's pretty much another thing that, of course, down in Santa Fe, you may not have that issue. They do have government facilities, but of course, all the Northeast states are quite involved with organized labor, and you have, I guess, planned labor agreements where someone's doing a big development that might last for 15 years, and they may need some people, and they may make arrangements with the local. Do you find, and I think Larry once told us that you have a direct entry into the apprenticeship programs in Local 12. Does that still work for you sometimes?
Yeah, it does sometimes. We don't actually have like a guaranteed slot, but definitely we get first preference compared to other agencies. They will contact us directly, which is actually mm-hmm. really good.
That's when we're in a time where they're looking for workers, and it's great to be associated with a local business manager and local, but that works against you when there's a surplus of people, and if he's got people on the bench, there's not a great likelihood he's going to be looking to your organization for people. But you have actually been able, I recall those years between 2009 and 2014 when we were in that recession and everyone was struggling. And I think St. Nick's was right up there with everyone else, wasn't it? And it was, it was a rough time. I like the idea of the free recertification. It's almost a tracking. You know, one of the conditions of the job training grant is that you have some kind of tracking program going on. And if you offer free recertification to your graduates, they not only bond with the program, they come back and they act as mentors and they get recertifications. And they also are great with your new students, and they can act as potential employers by giving someone a good recommendation where they're working. And I think not many of our grantees offer that service, and it seems like it has. Have you found that it's been a drain on your program at all in terms of resources?
No, not at all. It actually helps because it keeps them engaged, and then it also increases the success of them being placed and continue working on the job.
I imagine there's probably times when people have gotten jobs or recommendations from one of your graduates coming back.
Yeah.
When we talk about certs and recertifications, keeping a list of your graduates, having them come back to the program, they serve multi-purposes. They, one, not only act as mentors to your existing students, they act as, they're not going to be employing your students, but they could tell them about job openings. They can refer them on to their program, or they could just say, hey, you know, I think 6 months from now there's this new push on what we're doing, and you might have a good opportunity with this company, so why don't you contact me or something like that. Another thing that's related to that, and I don't know if you do this, but some people have, say someone goes to work, one of your graduates, and he becomes unemployed. Do you help him out in terms of helping him get another job, you know, put him back into the queue, so to speak, with your contacts that you have?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do. Because we want to make sure that they know that we're there for them. So we do have participants that work a job that's only like 2 months long. Usually what we do, we tell them, like, if we know that their contract is going to end, we tell them to reach out to us before that. So then you can meet with the account manager, and the account manager start sending their resume out. So we usually try to be proactive because we don't want anyone to not be employed. So the proactive approach actually helps, because then if a contract ends in 2 months, they know that they will be getting another job after that.
Oh, sorry. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, it's interesting that keeping that list and that group together, we haven't had – well, you had a hurricane up there, but when Katrina hit and some of the others, these national firms were saying, anyone, do you know anyone? They were calling all our grantees, and they said, do you know anyone that's got 1910-120 ASWAP, or do you have anyone that's got confined space? We need them down here. We'll pay for their housing. We'll take care of them. We'll pay them per diem. And a lot of our grantees during those periods, they didn't lose their graduates, but some had to, on the West Coast during the fires, they had to graduate early for their jobs. And another reason to keep close to your graduates that you're placing.
Yeah.
The way we
actually contact them is via, we have a database that allows us to know who has what certification, when did they graduate. A lot of the effort is just tracking them, and also we do case notes. I think case notes has been one of the things that allow us to, any staff member to know what's going on with any participant at any point in time, because we definitely believe in building strong relationships and rapport. That definitely has helped St. Nick's re-engage our clients, if anything, and just obviously just tracking their progress.
And how do you do that? Someone assigned to each graduate, or how do you do that?
We divide up the we have something called cohorts. We divide them up amongst the staff. And so even though they're like, we always at the forefront say that even though you're an employee of St. Nick's, you're definitely representing St. Nick's. So when you're meeting with the participant, they're building a bond with St. Nick's. So what usually happens is that when we're talking to them, they're informing us about their, you know, what's going on at work. We definitely document it in a case note, and we definitely like to do like random calls sometimes where we're just checking in on them, not because we want anything. We just want to see how things are going. We know that going the extra mile definitely helps with not just retention efforts, but also the fact that they feel supported and they feel motivated that they have a team behind them.
I think that's a great idea, and it's one of the reasons you survive those downtimes and you seem to continue going on. How are things looking right now in terms of the job market in Brooklyn?
So what happened is they said that everyone who's working on site must have the OSHA 30. I think it went in effect June 1st, but they're giving other sites an extension to October 1st. So I noticed that a lot of employers have been reaching out to us because we made it a standard. So like I said before, we have a committee that can foresee certain things. So even from last year, we kind of knew they were going to roll out this, you needed the OSHA 30 to work on any site. So the committee got together and we changed our curriculum to make sure that we had the industry standard certification. So then once we did our first cohort, a lot of the employers started reaching out to us because we actually had the certification that they needed. So just being proactive and engaging in with employers, knowing exactly what they need even before they know they need it, definitely made us more lucrative to stay ahead of the curve.
You know, Ivan, that's something, a concept I have never come across before. We emphasize in our program, and we call it a critical issue, to do a needs assessment. And most people do it when they write their grant. What are the demands? What do people need? And they have advisory boards, okay? Advisory boards meet and talk about curriculum. But you've gone a step further, which is really interesting. I would almost call it a needs assessment committee that is specifically looking at the needs and looking forward. That is really cool and innovative. I don't know anyone else that's doing that. But to anticipate not what used to be needed, but what might be coming up ahead of time is a clever idea.
It's excellent. It really is.
Yeah. It's something to consider. And that could be an informal committee of just some people saying, okay, what are we going to need 5 years out? What, you know, those of you who know OSHA, are we going to have a new OSHA reg coming up here that we have to worry about? You know, is there something new? And you'll be offering it, because I think at St. Nick's, you email your potential employers with the certs that you're going to be offering. So way before, not at graduation time, but at the beginning of the program. So, for example, if you're going to be offering 30, OSHA 30, they're going to know 3 months before that your graduates have it and someone else. You know, right now there's been that back and forth on the silica OSHA standards, and it may not necessarily apply to your program, but it's on again, it's off again. But again, that's an example of another one that might be popping up. Well, very good. We're going to, in the post-session notes, and actually coming up at the end of this month, we have a Connect newsletter that comes out every 2 months. We're going to be talking about placement. And particularly in the Connect newsletter, we're going to try to list all of these strategies we've been talking about in the last couple of PLC sessions. Just an idea, kind of a check-off thing. Are we doing this? Do we want to consider it? Is it some idea we may want to think about? Well, we do try to limit these to 30 minutes. Does anyone have any questions of Ivan or about placement right now?
I have one question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Our clients are probably pretty much similar to yours. What we find, and this may be different with you, what we find is one of our problem areas is driver's licenses. Employers want driver's licenses, and many of our clients have either never had a license or don't have a valid license. Do you have that problem, and how do you get around it?
We actually do have that problem. Our cohorts are only 7 weeks long. The time it'll take for them to actually get their driver's license will supersede that. However, the thing is, yeah, we actually don't have that in our contract to pay for driver's license. We could, I guess, but as of now, we haven't allocated any money towards that. But what we have been doing is the participant would get the driver's license if needed. But most of our participants in New York, they definitely either have a permit. So what we would do is try to leverage that relationship that we have with the employer to say that they have a permit. Is it possible that they can be with a licensed driver? If that doesn't work, we then advocate for the participant to see if they can obtain their driver's license. We also try to give them a window where, okay, if you hire this participant, can you give them a 3-month window that allow us to work with them to see if we can get their driver's license? So we try to come up with creative solutions because we definitely don't want to get them not employed, but we definitely want to try every single angle before we just give up and don't get them placed.
What is the driver's permit? Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt. What is a driver's permit?
A permit just says that they have to be with a licensed driver.
But that normally doesn't work. What we have found is even if the employer says, okay, get your license, or they'll never say a permit, the insurance company that does the motor vehicle insurance for the employer will then look and say no. And that is a problem, aside from the fact that there is no federal money. And I don't know about New York, but New Jersey, if you're over 17, it's still going to cost about $300 or $400 for driving lessons and a license. Not to mention, many employers require you to have a means of transportation.
Yeah,
so you kind of have a double.
Yeah. This is a very interesting and important question because now if you're in Brooklyn, you still need driver's license, but in urban areas, you may have transportation on buses and things like that, good strong transportation networks. But in areas, for example, in Chicago, I call them employer deserts. They're not food deserts. They're employer deserts. There are no jobs in environmental remediation that you can't get to without a car. And now, how do you deal with this? And the question is, if companies are big enough that you might be able to get them to a training center and then they pick them up and carpool them. But you're exactly right. And we've addressed this problem in the past, and I think we continue to address this problem. Now, EPA, with the EPA money, you can get a CDL. You can get a commercial driver's license, but you can't get...
You have to be 21, and you have to be licensed for 2 years.
Right.
So you can't just have somebody pay the money, get their license, and then get CDL training. They're not eligible.
Right. So how have you tried to address this issue? Do you go back to the recruitment process? You know, here's another issue that we talk about in other PLCs. You can't – the objective of this is – placement. So do you work backwards? We suggest people work backwards. Now, if you've got 20 slots, you've got to ration slots. So you've got to take the 20 most deserving. And we do this in other areas like ability to taking a TAB test or whatever, the ability to pass the curriculum or in some cases drugs, whatever. We suggest, and it sounds kind of callous, but you work backwards from employment to find out with your needs assessment what kind of employers and what they require that you hire. If to give you an extreme, if your only employer, and we talked about this at Santa Fe, and they have other employers fortunately, but if your only employer is a government lab and you have to have security clearance and you can't have any infractions, well, you have to work backwards to your recruiting. And you as callous as it sounds, you can't, as a condition of being screened in the program, that may be a condition of employment. There may be, you know, if you can't adapt backwards, then you have to, if you can't adapt forwards, then you have to adapt backwards, where you might say, our employers, we only have a certain number of people that may not have driver's license, but you may not be able to get into the program. And it may be a condition in your screening process to get into the program. Now, that sounds cruel, but again, say you have 50 applicants and you've got 25 or 30 that have driver's license and you have 20 that don't, and they all have equal desire, they all have equal need, they all have all the conditions in your screening process, who do you take? And that gets back to your working this whole thing in reverse. You're going to have to take the ones that you know that there's going to be a job for them at the end of the tunnel. That is an approach, perhaps not the one we like to use. But I think there are programs that do require that you have a CDL to get, I mean, not a CDL, a regular driver's license to get into the program. And you may have to do that.
Yeah, our problem is it would overwhelmingly reject many of our low-income and usually minority candidates, because
right.
they are the ones that have the greatest, and that, I mean, and my office, that is our population. We are still searching for some way where there is some foundation or federal funding or state funding entity that will provide initial driver's license, you know, road training.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody does. It is a totally unallowable expense.
Right, right. We found the same thing. And
yeah.
But you have an excellent point. And, you know, the approach I use is that's a desperate approach. And you're not really addressing the true group that you want to address. There are some cities that have good transportation networks. What city are you? Are you in an urban area or a rural area?
We're in Essex County, so we're kind of similar to Brooklyn. But the issue is many of our sites, just like many of the sites in New York, are not, New York may be a little bit better, but are not within public transportation locations. If you're working for a construction company, you may be 3 weeks here and 3 weeks there, and they are not necessarily, and the time frame may not actually get you to those locations unless you happen to be working somewhere in, you know, right in the downtown area. There's a problem. It's different than Chicago.
Right. Like I said, they're urban deserts. They're employer deserts. There's just no work within your target community.
Well, there is work. And it's just the issue is if you're working for an employer, you are not necessarily working forever at that single site. And usually the engineering, the companies have multiple jobs. And if you want to stay with them, you have to be able to get to those jobs.
That's right. Or you have to have an employer that needs workers bad enough that he's willing to basically carpool.
Yeah.
Where if you could get to this local point, if you could get to this point by bus or whatever, we'll get you to the job site. In other words, we're going to import our workers, which would be another possibility. Again, not the best one, but again, you're right. I think we should probably focus, and that's a good challenge to focus to try to find some program, whether it's, and it may have to be a state program. We've done all things around it. We've done transportation, bus and cities and states that have given bus passes, subsidized and free passes for 6 months. We've actually even had a car dealership that was giving discounts to graduates. So, but we've done all the things, but what you said is a real need.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very good point. Will anyone out there that's got any ideas That's what we call it, the group brain. That's the purpose of what we do and the all-grantee meeting. If this was Alexandria and we were having our all-grantee meeting, we would sit here and with 150 people, with about 70 grantees and EPA people, and say, okay, what do we do? What do we do?
Quite honestly, I would say that it would look for a foundation source, because that's private money, a foundation source that would be willing to provide the funding needed per person to get a driver's license. Because, like I said, you know, the license is the first step.
Right.
And that is, you know, that's the only way a single employer, well, everybody isn't going to work for the same employer, but I would say it would be for all, even the urban areas, the suburban areas. I don't know if they have the same issues, but it's getting the license.
Yeah. I would expect the more rural it is, the worse it is. And that's a life skill. You're really talking about a life skill. And the way we approach life skills from the EPA point of view is that money is leverage money that comes from foundations. So I think you're on a path of somehow locating foundations.
No public money pays for it.
No,
I mean,
no.
Zero.
Well, EPA certainly wouldn't, because it is a life skill, and it doesn't have to do with remediation. Now, CDLs do, because if you're hauling hazardous materials, they could fund something like that. But a driver's license, like you say, it's a life skill, so which points to foundation money, and the trick is that's kind of local. It's a local issue.
Oh, there are national foundations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a good project to work on, and thanks for bringing this up. That's what we're here for, to dry data, because we could identify issues, we could bring them up to EPA, we could bring it up to NIHS and say, and the rest of the grantees, and say, you know, how are you handling? Because if you've got this problem, everyone else does too.
Well, not out here in New Mexico. We get our car keys when we're 16.
You get guns and car keys.
That's right. You know, and tortillas. So
I think it's,
well, how do you handle it? You don't.
Car insurance is less expensive.
Yeah. Now, Janet, how do you handle it? Do you not accept someone if they don't have a driver's license?
Doesn't even come up. Everybody's got a car. Everybody's got their driver's license.
Okay. Does anyone out there have it as a restriction to enter the program? No? Okay. Interesting.
No, we don't.
We'll have to bring it up in a larger group. I think there are people that do require it as a, just like they would require a high school education or a GED, they would require a driver's license. So that may be an unfortunate solution, you know, if there are no others. If it's a question of not being, of going through 7 weeks of training and no job, or not entering the program, then you would probably need to opt out for, you can't enter the program because we know you can't get a job. You know, unless you could locate some employers that say, oh, we could do that. We'll carpool or something like that. But this is what makes this work fun. So, well, listen, thanks, everybody. Those are great questions. And thanks, Ivan. Anyone else have a question before we leave? Okay. Well, we'll continue these discussions, and hopefully we'll see you all towards the end of August on the 28th.
Thank you, Mike.
Y'all have a good day. Any comments, just send them in, and
no problem.
We'll see what we can do. Again, thanks, Ivan.
No problem. Take care.